President Obama was in Phoenix today talking about your new home. And he wants to put more money in the pockets of first-time buyers.
Starting this month, the Federal Housing Authority will lower its mortgage insurance premium rates enough to save the average new borrower more than $900 a year.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, how the drought may be slowing global warming. Could the Valley actually benefit from the Cardinals missing the Super Bowl?
And efforts to get more women involved in the legal marijuana industry.
Women tend to be more risk-averse, especially women who are mothers. And when it comes to committing a federal crime every day, you know, that's certainly a risk.
Plus, lower gas prices are leading to calls for higher gas taxes and learning to fix a bike.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
President Barack Obama was in the Valley this morning speaking at Central High School about housing and the Valley's housing market. KJZZ's Carrie Young was there and joins me now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. So what was the scene like today in the high school gym?
The high school gym was packed today. There were about 200 or 300 people in the gym, at my count. But energy was high. Everyone was pretty excited to hear the president speak and to hear his announcement.
And what did he have to say?
The president stopped in Phoenix to promote plans to cut the Federal Housing Administration's mortgage insurance premium rates for new home buyers. It at one point had been 1.35%. That's now getting lowered to 0.85%. And the White House estimates that that could save new homeowners about $900 a year in their mortgage payments. So President Obama was excited to make this announcement because to him this was more of a rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing.
If your neighbors are buying more homes, that's lifting the whole market here, which means the value of your home starts going up. And that's good for you.
President Obama speaking this morning at Central High School in Phoenix. KJZZ's Carrie Young is with me. She was there this morning. Carrie, what was reaction like to what the president had to say? What did people think of it?
Well, Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton was actually pretty excited to hear the announcement, similar to the lines of what President Obama had to say.
The more we can get responsible first-time homebuyers into homes, the better is for our economy. And we have to grow this economy. Phoenix is heading in the right direction, and today's announcement is going to help keep pushing us in the right direction. So I'm excited about what the president announced today.
Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton responding to President Obama's address this morning. Carrie, any reaction from the real estate industry?
Yes, I did speak to one realtor, Kathy Allen.
I think it's just going to make our job a lot easier, getting young folks into new homes. And our whole team will benefit from this because not only realtors, but our lenders will also be able to get more loans out there and more people into homes for the first time. That's great. It's good news.
Valley Realtor Kathy Allen. I've been joined by KJZZ's Carrie Young, who covered this morning's speech in Phoenix by President Obama. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
Local housing experts were generally supportive of President Obama's plan to drop some costs of mortgages backed by the Federal Housing Administration. As KJZZ's business correspondent Christina Hansen reports, the concern in Phoenix is whether there are enough homes for sale to support any increase in demand that the president's plan hopes to achieve.
For decades, Americans with lower incomes and less than perfect credit have used FHA loans to buy a house because interest rates and down payment requirements are much lower than conventional loans. But the downside is an extra cost called mortgage insurance. And over the past several years, the Federal Housing Administration has raised those annual premiums substantially. On Thursday at Central High School in Phoenix, President Obama rolled out plans to drop those premiums from 1.35% to 0.85%.
These rates are for responsible buyers. We're not going down the road again of financing folks buying things they can't afford.
The goal is to boost demand at a time when the housing market's recovery has been much slower than expected. With prices now back up to 2004 levels, investors have been pulling back. But traditional buyers, especially first-time buyers, haven't been picking up the slack. That's largely because it's become much harder to qualify for a loan today. Obama's plan doesn't address that issue, but Paul Hickman, head of the Arizona Bankers Association, says it'll make home buying more affordable for some.
It's supply and demand. You know, you reduce price and you'll increase demand. And so they'll have more folks that can come in and potentially buy a house. And that's a good thing from our point of view.
Mike Orr, a housing expert at ASU, says his concern for Phoenix is about supply. He says the number of homes for sale right now is unusually low, which hasn't been a problem because demand is also low. But that could change with Obama's plan and the fact that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have dropped their down payment requirement to 3%, which is even lower than FHA loans.
If demand suddenly shot back all the way to normal, because it's a long way below normal still, then supply, being quite a long way below normal, would be overwhelmed pretty quickly.
And that, he says, might put Phoenix back into the situation it was in just a few years ago, when bidding wars were the norm and prices were soaring. Christina Hansen, KJZZ News.
When you think about just how dry Arizona, the rest of the Southwest, and California have been for more than a decade, does it seem possible that it's being caused by unusually strong winds? What if those same winds were also limiting the effects of global warming? That's what Thomas Delworth, a climate scientist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Princeton, New Jersey, proposed in research presented at the American Meteorological Society's annual meeting in Phoenix this week.
Over the last 10 or 15 years, we have not seen much warming of the entire planet, and so we've had to try and look at mechanisms that could be responsible for that. There are several possibilities, but one of the most interesting and intriguing possibilities is the following. It turns out that over that period, we've had unusually strong winds blowing from the eastern part of the Pacific to the western part of the Pacific. The effect of those winds is actually to bring up colder water in the eastern part of the Pacific to the surface and actually push water westward. The result of those winds is a big pool of cold water in the eastern Pacific. That actually helps to cool the planet, or rather offset the warming we would be experiencing due to greenhouse gases. And so that's why this process is linked to this hiatus or pause in global warming. A secondary effect is that those winds create the cold water, which actually changes the large-scale circulation of the planet, how the winds blow. And one of the results of that is that over the western part of North America, we tend in general to have somewhat higher pressure than normal. And that higher pressure steers storms to the northward so that we don't get as much rainfall over the western part of North America.
Tom, how long has this pattern been in effect? And is there any way to project how much longer it would last?
The so-called hiatus in warming is really started perhaps around the year 2000. It's a little bit fuzzy exactly when it starts. That's somewhat subjective. So this has been an ongoing pattern for more than a decade now. We don't really understand what's causing those enhanced winds. Is that due to simply random variability of the coupled system, or is there some other forcing agent? For example, we expect, our best models show, that in response to increasing greenhouse gases, we actually think the winds in the tropical Pacific should have more of a west-to-east component. That is, in the tropical Pacific, the mean winds blow from east to west. We think that global warming should reduce the strength of those winds. What we've seen in the last 10 or 15 years is an increase in the strength of those winds. So it's a bit puzzling to us why this has happened. The leading theory is this is just part of the natural variability of the climate system, that things can swing back and forth.
Tom, obviously the Southwest is no stranger to long-term droughts. Have you worked with anyone, as far as the report is concerned, on weather history or atmospheric history or anything to see if there was a pattern of winds, that how long it lasted in a particular drought in the Southwest, that might in fact give you an idea of how similar they are, how different, or how it might change going forward?
We have records that we've reconstructed for at least 1,000 years over the western part of North America from tree rings and other proxy records of the climate system. And almost all those studies show that this association is pretty clear between cold conditions in the eastern tropical Pacific and drier than normal conditions over the western part of North America. So in that sense, this drought is quite typical. Now, it's extending for over a decade, and so that makes it somewhat longer than some other droughts. But we have examples from records reconstructed from things like tree rings that, say, 1,000 years ago, we had droughts that were much longer in duration. So it's really hard to say how long this will continue because we don't have a really firm grasp on why the winds have increased, and is this simply due to natural variability. So unfortunately, right now, our ability to predict how long this will continue is not very high. It's a very active research topic, something we're trying to understand, but there are potential limits in that predictability.
Thomas Delworth is a climate scientist at NOAA in Princeton, New Jersey. Dr. Delworth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Arizonans on average died of alcohol poisoning each year between 2010 and 2012, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The state's rate of almost 19 such deaths per million residents was the fourth worst in the country over that time. Nationally, six Americans died on average each day from alcohol poisoning. Dr. Robert Brewer leads the CDC's alcohol program. He says that's a shocking number of deaths tied directly to high-volume binge drinking.
That's a shocking number of deaths that are directly tied to binge drinking at high intensity.
When you look at the states that had the biggest problems, it seemed that a good number of them were in this part of the country in the West. Is there anything to which you can attribute that?
Well, one of the very important factors influencing differences in alcohol poisoning death rates across states have to do with the policies that states have in place that regulate alcohol, and that would include policies related to, for example, the price and the availability of alcoholic beverages. In addition, while binge drinking is the major driver for alcohol poisoning deaths across the country, we also know that there are other factors that can influence death from alcohol poisoning. And states that tend to have a larger proportion of the population who live in rural or sometimes frontier areas may be at higher risk of alcohol poisoning deaths too. And sadly, that may be due to the fact that some people who binge drink at high levels may not be found for some time after they pass out as a result of drinking too much and may die as a result of their not getting appropriate medical care.
What do you think has to happen for these numbers to come down?
I think we really need to look at what the science tells us are the kind of strategies that can work to reduce binge drinking, because the key to preventing alcohol poisoning deaths is really to prevent binge drinking. And the good news there is that there are a number of different strategies that the science has told us can work very well to reduce binge drinking. For example, it turns out that alcohol consumption is very sensitive to price. If alcohol is more expensive, people tend to drink less. We also know that alcohol consumption, and particularly alcohol consumption by people who are drinking too much, is very much affected by the availability of alcohol. So, for example, if you can set reasonable controls on the number of places where people can purchase alcohol, whether that be at liquor stores or bars or elsewhere, that can really help to reduce excessive alcohol use as well.
Dr. Robert Brewer leads the alcohol program at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Still to come, a gallon of gas costs just about $2 in Arizona. Does that mean the gas tax should go up?
It's arguable that the gas tax has really fallen behind the times when you adjust it for inflation. On the other hand, we're not building a brand new interstate system anymore.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It'll stay cloudy tonight around the valley. We're expecting low temperatures around 50, and then there's a slight chance of rain tomorrow. Look for a high of 71 degrees. It's currently partly cloudy and 69 at KJZZ. Quick check of valley traffic. An accident on the 101 westbound in the North Valley. That's at 7th Avenue, and it's currently blocking the shoulder.
KJZZ is supported by The Persian Room, health-conscious Persian cuisine for lunch and dinner, plus catering for your special occasions and business events. The Persian Room on Scottsdale Road, one light north of Bell, 480-614-1414.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Antibiotics are miracle drugs. They fight bacterial infection. They change the world. They're also miracle drugs with a flawed business model, apparently.
The industry, according to the World Health Organization, has slowed its development of advanced antibiotics, and the lack of new antibiotics is a significant threat to global health. In the U.S., 2 million Americans a year are infected with drug-resistant bacteria, killing at least 23,000.
It's been nearly 30 years since the last big breakthrough in antibiotic discovery, but this week researchers discovered a powerful new antibiotic called Taxobactin that can kill an array of germs without fear that they will become easily resistant. Denise Grady is health and medicine reporter at our partner, The New York Times. Denise, welcome.
Thank you, John.
What is the significance of Texobactin in how it works and that it even got developed? I gather both are important headlines.
They are both pretty exciting developments. The drug itself looks like it is pretty powerful, does not appear to have side effects in animals, and works in a way that's different from other antibiotics so that it seems as if the germs will be less likely to become resistant to it. Now, all of this is still on the drawing board because it hasn't been tested in people yet, but it's looking pretty good. But as you said, just as exciting as the drug itself is the way that these researchers found it, because they came up with a technique that has the potential to open up the door to all kinds of new antibiotics that were beyond reach before, because they were made by bacteria that could not be grown in the lab. And these guys figured out a very clever way to grow all kinds of bacteria that before people couldn't culture in the laboratory. And that is something like 99% of all of the strains of bacteria out there. So it's like, kind of like opening up a potential treasure chest.
So this is a little like agriculture. You use bacteria to develop and grow the toxins that become the antibiotics. It's the penicillin story, only with a whole new class of organisms.
That's right. And what's going on is that bacteria are in constant chemical or biological warfare against each other. You know, they're all competing for spots in the world, and they make these antibiotics to try to knock each other out. And so we can then try to steal those chemicals and use them ourselves.
And antibiotics typically have the effect of straining the liver and in some cases being pretty difficult drugs to actually administer. What are the tests going to have to show here?
They're going to have to prove that the drugs are safe in people. So far, they look really good in mice, but mice aren't people. So there are going to have to be clinical trials, and they will have to look over time at a variety of types of people. I mean, different ages, different illnesses, different backgrounds, to make sure that the drugs are safe. And as one of the experts we talked to said, that safety, toxicity is often the Achilles heel when you're developing a new drug. There are plenty of things that look promising, and then they come along and you start putting them into people and you find out there's something there that you didn't know about.
What is the class of diseases or population that we've run out of tools for treating with bacterial illnesses?
There are a huge number of infections that have become resistant. One of them is tuberculosis. Right now, people who have TB need to be treated with multiple drugs for quite a long time to get rid of it. And there are some forms of it that are resistant to just about everything. Gonorrhea has become resistant to a lot of drugs. There are a lot of skin infections that sounds like it might be trivial, but there are just infections that you can be very hard to get rid of. People wind up needing intravenous antibiotics for months. There is drug-resistant pneumonia. There are foodborne infections that are hard to treat. So there's just a whole array of diseases that are becoming harder and harder to treat.
The hospital-borne infection that we often hear about, MRSA, which I gather is one of those skin-attacking, drug-resistant bacterias, would this Texobactin be something that would be naturally applied to MRSA?
It looks like it will work against MRSA. They tested it in mice with MRSA, and it did work. There are different strains of MRSA, so it's going to need more testing to find out if it's really going to hold up against all of them. But so far, it looked good.
What is the weakness or disincentive on the part of the industry to develop drugs like this, and how can that be boosted by either subsidies or a government action to encourage the development of these kinds of drugs?
Well, the disadvantage for the makers is that, first of all, you shouldn't have to take these drugs for a long time. So you or I catch something and we get treated for, 5 days, 7 days, 10 days. Then they make these drugs, And when they make a good one, the infectious disease doctors will say, oh, please don't use this. Hold it in reserve unless nothing else works, and then pull it out. So you make something great, and then people are afraid to use it because they don't want the germs to become resistant to it. Then if the germs do become resistant to it, then there goes your product. So it can be difficult to make a whole lot of money from these drugs. So that has become a disincentive for drug companies. When you think about drugs like statins that people will wind up taking every day for their whole lives, or then you can see why you would want to put your money there. Or even, you know, something like Viagra that people are going to want to take all the time and not have these concerns. So that has been a disincentive. There's going to be a need to, from the government has expressed some interest in trying to help provide incentives for companies to develop these drugs. Maybe financial incentives, help them out financially, or give them some kind of break on patents. But so far, some of that seems to be helping because a few of the drug companies do seem to be coming back into the antibiotic market. But anything new that's coming out is probably going to wind up being very, very expensive.
Well, we'll see if the Texobactin experience encourages any of those incentives and other companies to get involved. Denise Grady, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Denise Grady is health and medicine reporter at our partner, the New York Times.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry.
Arizona's average gas price is just more than $2 a gallon. The national average isn't much higher than that. Those dropping prices have led some in Congress to call for increasing the federal gas tax for the first time in more than two decades. The federal tax currently stands at a little more than 18 cents. Arizona's gas tax is about the same. To talk more about that idea, we called on Byron Schlomach, an economist with the Goldwater Institute.
To the extent that more money helps you build more stuff, sure, it helps with our infrastructure needs. The problem, though, and I think one of the major issues when it comes to infrastructure has to do with prioritization and how the money is currently being spent.
By that, do you mean that the state needs to do a better job of figuring out which projects it really needs to pursue and how much it'll actually cost to do those and not others?
Absolutely. You put that very well. When I'm looking at the big effort to finish out Loop 303, for example, and then I'm observing the large amount of congestion on I-10, I think there is a bigger problem on I-10, and that's something that needs to be addressed and really should have been addressed first.
So when you're looking at prioritizing transportation projects, what are the criteria that you're looking for that need to be met before a project should be green-lighted and funded?
Well, the number one thing that they need to do is evaluate what a project will do to congestion. And, of course, there are ancillary benefits from that, like reduced pollution. So there are other benefits besides just congestion, but that's the main thing that they need to prioritize.
What do you make of the argument that transportation corridors can help economic development?
I think that's absolutely true. Transportation is absolutely central to economic development. You can't import items and export items between cities, much less across states and countries, without roads and other types of transportation infrastructure. So it's integral and absolutely important. But that's one reason why getting the priorities correct is so important, and it's certainly not a reason to be inefficient with how you spend the money.
Do people actually know how much they're paying in gas tax?
I'll be honest. I think to some extent people think they're paying more in gas tax than they actually are these days. The gas tax hasn't risen since 1991 in Arizona at the state level. It's practically the same period of time at the federal level. Prices have very nearly doubled since then. So it's arguable that the gas tax has really fallen behind the times when you adjust it for inflation. On the other hand, we're not building a brand new interstate system anymore. So it's arguable that it doesn't need to be as high as it was in real terms in 1991. But at the same time, even with that drop in the tax in real terms, we've been holding our own, and in some ways even better than that in transportation.
Given the fact that it seems fairly unlikely that state lawmakers and the governor will vote to increase the gas tax, and also given that roads and bridges and other infrastructure does need money, do you think that the answer is something that's been talked about here in the past, which is perhaps privatizing some roads, maybe toll roads, things like that?
I absolutely believe that is really the answer when it comes to highways that are limited access, like the interstates. We need to use true user fees based on people's actual use of the roads as opposed to this very vague pricing that we sort of use with the gasoline tax.
Byron Schlomach is an economist at the Goldwater Institute.
Canal banks have been part of the Valley's landscape for many decades, and they're used by bike riders, dog walkers, and people who need to walk from place to place. Now there's a new ambitious effort to upgrade Grand Canal in uptown Phoenix and around Sky Harbor Airport. Kerry Wilcoxon is a traffic engineer for the city of Phoenix. Kerry, the canal banks were a big part of my childhood here in Phoenix, but a lot of people are probably thinking, why is money being spent on this? So what are some details of the project?
That's actually a common response we get, depending on where you lived or where you grew up in the Valley. And one of the reasons why we're doing the project, in fact, the Grand Canalscape project is a larger project that we're hoping to provide a contiguous pathway along the banks of the Grand Canal, which runs through central Phoenix from Tempe to Glendale. One of the reasons we're doing that is to try and provide a convenient pedestrian and bicycle corridor where people can go from one end of the city to the other without having to use the surface streets. But really the main goal of the Grand Canalscape project is to reintroduce or reintegrate the canals into life in Phoenix. Phoenix, as we know it, wouldn't be here without the canals and the water they bring. And the Canalscape, we're hoping, will provide people with an opportunity to recognize and celebrate that, as well as get some exercise and be able to maybe leave the car at home sometimes.
This area has this reputation of being a transient place where people don't really feel as close to their neighbors and whatnot. And I wonder if this could be some sort of part of making this even more of a community place where people feel like they're really more in tune with Phoenix by sort of blending the history with some of the other things you're mentioning.
Absolutely. We envision the project, not just the phase one that we're talking about now, but we envision the whole project as a way to sort of drive people to the canalscapes and to make the canalscapes, apart from how we get water, make them a place where you can walk and bike and get to know your neighbors. As part of that, though, and an integral part of that will be when the canalscape is built, we're going to have to make sure that we light it, make sure that there are pedestrian-level lighting all along the canal. We're hoping that that will not only drive out some of the unsavory elements, but it will also make the canal more inviting for people to do the kinds of things that we want them doing there.
If it all works out well, what's the time frame?
We have been approved for what's known as phase one of the project, which will run from 15th Avenue in the west all the way over to 16th Street and Indian School on the east side. And then there's a smaller chunk that runs from Garfield to Van Buren. That's phase one. And because of the funding source, which is SRP aesthetic funds, mm-hmm. we have a two-year limit on when we have to use those for. So we have to be finished with the work on this canal, this phase of the canalscape, by September 2016. Once we get finished with phase one, we're hoping that the next phase works towards the east to try and connect the phase one work closer to the airport, McDowell Road, eventually bridging all the way to Tempe. We also want to try and work maybe on some of the later phases to the west.
I'm glad you mentioned funding, only because when people hear a project going on and they think about, oh, the city of Phoenix is undergoing some budget issues right now, SRP aesthetic funds providing about 80% of the money for that. Is that correct?
They're actually providing more like 90%.
Okay.
But yeah, they have a pot of money that they give to municipalities that have canals running through them. that can be used for things like canalscapes, other aesthetic projects. We applied, as did other projects in the city of Phoenix, for the funds and got approved. So we'll be competing again once this project is completed. But we're hoping that through outreach, through building community excitement about this project, that we can get people to really support and push for this project expanding into the future.
Kerry Wilcoxon, City of Phoenix traffic engineer. A public meeting on the Grand Canal project will be held tonight at 6:30 at Osborne Middle School. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Perry Fanzo. I am a volunteer here at the Humane Society. I've been here for 13 years.
Hi, Diwali. Hi.
And we try to make sure that they feel comfortable with the animal, and it seems like it's a good fit.
You want to hold the leash?
Yeah.
Good. Maybe you can catch the dog and you put her up at the leash.
And the most important thing is when you come into a shelter is you need to ask the people to bring the animal out of the kennel for you to see it, the cat or the dog. Because their behavior outside is so totally different than what is inside.
Hey, Cinnamon.
Come here. She answers to a name, too.
Cinnamon. Sit.
So I really like dogs a lot, and that's the major reason I guess I do this. I just really enjoy being around them.
No, she wants to play.
She wants to play.
You want to take her home?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you got to go home.
That's volunteer Perry Fanzo at the Humane Society in Phoenix. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to put us in the doghouse, send us a note, the show, at kjzz.org.
Still to come, since they lost in the first round of the NFL playoffs, the Arizona Cardinals won't be hosting the Super Bowl. That may help bring more big spenders to the Valley.
There are side events, and that's where these people are spending a lot more money than somebody who just comes around to sit around the pool for 3 days.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. These clouds will stick around tonight in the valley. Look for lows to be around 50 degrees. For tomorrow, partly cloudy. Actually, a 10% chance for rain at a high of 71 degrees. Currently, it's partly cloudy. We're at 69 at KJZZ. Valley traffic, an accident on the 101 westbound in the North Valley at 7th Avenue. Not seeing any sort of backup from that yet.
KJZZ is supported by Xavier College Preparatory, a Roman Catholic high school for young women, administering an entrance exam this Saturday at 7:30 a.m. for interested 8th graders. No reservation required. Info at xcp.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Tens of thousands of police and military personnel are searching an area northeast of Paris for the two heavily armed brothers who are suspects in the attack on the office of a satirical magazine in Paris. That attack left a dozen people dead. The brothers are said to be linked to an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki says the U.S. has offered to provide any assistance that French authorities might need.
We've had a long-standing counterterrorism cooperation with France. That's been continuing. Obviously, that includes intel sharing. We've made clear, and the president's indicated this, as has the secretary, that we will provide them any information or assistance that they would like.
French police have been deployed at railway and transit stations and other publication offices to guard against any follow-on attack. Blustery, frigid weather is gripping the Midwest, East, and South today, forcing school closings in a number of states as well as travel delays. Wind chill readings have been at or below zero as far south as Alabama. Davis Donovan of member station WSHU reports the severe weather is causing hardships for homeless people in New Haven, Connecticut.
New Haven has four regular shelters, and the city opened an additional six emergency hotspots for the homeless Wednesday night, but not everybody uses them. Jose Felix is a 44-year-old man living on the street. He found a place to stay, but says he was ready for the cold anyway.
Like, when it's cold, I just burn a lot of wood. I built a teepee, you know, like a teepee, a shed, whatever you want to call it. And I fill up this pot with all the coals that come out off the wood, and I bring it in, and it'd be warm. It'd be real nice and warm in there.
In 2014, the city had more than 500 people living without homes, according to a yearly study done by the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. For NPR News, I'm Davis Donovan in Connecticut.
Stocks extended their rally on Wall Street today. The Dow closed up 323 points. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
It's been 4 years since a shooting in Tucson left six people dead and several others injured, including former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. KJZZ's Kate Sheehy was at one of the city's bell-ringing ceremonies to mark the anniversary.
Six bells rang out starting at 10:10 a.m. to pay respect to the people who were killed in the shooting. Then another 13 bells for those injured. Then several moments of silence from the small crowd gathered in front of a fire department in downtown Tucson. Mayor Jonathan Rothschild connects the shooting in his city to yesterday's attack at the office of a satirical magazine in Paris, saying both were affronts to democracy.
As mayor, I want our community to always remember to be respectful, civil, but also diligent in protecting all of our rights.
He says the city has made progress since the shooting, but that more resources need to be dedicated to mental health services. The mayor says the way the community came together and continues to support one another brings him solace. Kate Sheehy, KJZZ News, Tucson.
Hey, Steve, you got change for a 10? No?
I don't.
No, you don't. Yeah, we're using paper money and coins less and less and turning to digits on a screen.
All signs that the cashless society has arrived. Of course, that depends where you are in the world. The BBC's Anna Holligan reports from the Netherlands and meets some of the pioneers ditching that old paper note and coins.
Our first stop is Amsterdam Central Station for a morning coffee with a man who calls himself Mr. Bitcoin. Martin Wismeyer has taken his commitment to cashless payment systems to the extreme, embedding a digital wallet under his skin. Can I feel?
Yeah, yeah, sure. Feels like it's a grain of rice. It's 12 by 2 millimeters. In the glass capsule, there's a little chip with an antenna. Bitcoins allows me to pay you directly on the internet without any banks. And with a chip like this, you can see it's like having an offshore bank account in your hand.
Do you worry that your hands may be targeted by people, bank robbers?
Yes, it's like people say, oh, your hands will be chopped off. And I don't believe that, because when fingerprints were introduced, they said the same thing about chopped off fingers. And we haven't seen a single case of stolen fingers because people want to unlock their iPhone. I had a lot of science fiction writers approach me. They said, you know, I don't believe it. You have got a chip in your hand. I'm a science fiction writer. I said, well, it's science fact now. Make up something new.
So we're back on the move again. Public transport, though, can often be a problem for tourists in this country. Many of the trams don't accept cash payments, so you need to swipe your OV chip card to travel. Otherwise, you'll be walking. The Netherlands has a unique online payment system called iDEAL. It allows you to shop online by linking directly to your online bank account, removing the need for cash or cards. So, if you were to order a takeaway, for example, the financial transaction takes place at the same time as you're placing the order. And this, of course, saves you from having to scrabble around to try to find the right amount of change when it finally arrives. So there are some supermarkets in the Netherlands which have banned cash altogether, and this is one of them. It's called Markt, and as soon as you're coming in, there is a warning. The note here on the door says, by Markt, alleen pinnen, which means in Markt, you can only use your PIN card. And underneath it says,
geen cash is veiliger, schoner en sneller. No cash is safer, cleaner and
quicker.
Yes.
Thank you. The man who introduced this purely digital payment system is the founder of Markt, Quirijn Bolle. We interrupted his holiday for a quick chat on Skype.
Armed robberies on supermarkets, that was actually the main reason to do it. The other reasons are that it's faster at checkout, so we have less lines for customers, and it's more sustainable to eliminate cash, because cash also implicates that you have to drive around with big armored trucks.
And was it difficult or expensive to implement this new system?
We actually don't know, because we just implemented it. We don't know what kind of sales we lose by doing this.
The crucial question here is, how do the customers feel about their limited options at the till?
It's actually quite convenient by comparison, to be honest. Some bakeries even have it where they use it for sort of hygiene purposes too, that you don't handle cash.
Do you think that this is the way that things will go in the future then?
Probably, yes. You don't sort of get caught out with not having the cash on you and having to run to the ATM or pockets full of change. And I was in London a few weeks ago, and then you end up with, you know, like an ever-growing pocket of 1p and 2p coins.
Bulge
and,
yeah, in your
and
pocket,
it's like, oh,
yeah.
I want to get rid of all these coins.
Yeah. You've just paid for your groceries.
Yeah.
What do you feel about only being able to use PIN cards?
I like it. Your wallet is less thick with all the money.
We've just seen one customer behind you walk out in frustration finding out that he can't use cash. Do you think that this is just a kind of matter of time before people adapt? And here in the Netherlands, everyone has one of these cards.
Yeah, it is. But I still can imagine that there are people who don't want to leave their personal stuff behind in the cash register.
Their footprints.
So, yes, their footprints, yes. The cash will never disappear. No. It still has some tradition, having money. It's more, how do you say that in English?
Tangible.
Yes, that's the word.
Do you think then it would be a kind of sad day if this was a purely cashless society?
Yeah. I guess, yes. It has something special. Real money.
Yeah,
I think so.
That's the BBC's Anna Holligan.
Women interested in getting involved in the medical marijuana industry will meet tonight in Phoenix. Women Grow launched its Phoenix chapter last month. Betty Aldworth is a founding member of Women Grow, which started in Colorado. She's also the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. She says Women Grow works to empower women working in the cannabis industry wherever it's legal.
In Arizona, there is a vibrant medical marijuana industry and medical marijuana community, and it only makes sense to have our presence there as it does everywhere else where that's the case.
What is the breakdown, as far as you can tell, between male and female in the marijuana industry right now?
I would say that much like any other industry, it is unfortunately heavily male-dominated. Probably 6 out of every 10 executives is male, if not more, and women are underrepresented at essentially every level.
Why do you think that is?
Every industry in America is still heavily male dominated. If you look at the statistics from, you know, small businesses to Congress, you see a very a disproportionate presence between men and women in leadership positions. So it's no surprise that the marijuana industry is the same. What I argue is that this is a brand new industry. We're creating it essentially out of whole cloth, and we have an opportunity to do better.
Do you think that this is an issue more of getting women into the industry in general, or getting women who are in the industry already into more leadership positions?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. And there's no question that, especially in the early years of quasi-legal medical marijuana businesses in states like Arizona and California and Colorado, it's easier for men to take those kinds of risks, especially those men who are not attached to families. The fact is that women tend to be more risk-averse, especially women who are mothers. And when it comes to committing a federal crime every day, you know, that's certainly a risk. Now, I think that we're seeing, you know, a lot of women very interested in the cannabis industry generally, and we're trying to make sure that we're elevating their voices and creating equitable workspaces where they have equal opportunities and are unhindered by things like harassment and pervasive ideas about women.
Are there challenges in this industry to getting women involved that maybe do not exist in other industries?
Well, sure. Of course, the legal status of cannabis is a massive barrier for a lot of people, especially women. But we also know that Socially, women tend to use cannabis and all other drugs, including alcohol, less frequently than men, and tend to be, again, more risk-averse. And so all of those things sort of compile into this distinct possibility that women are less inclined to become involved in the industry. That being said, women are more likely to make health decisions for their family, they're more likely to access alternative medicines, and they're most likely to be caregivers for the family. And so there is a natural draw to cannabis, if we're thinking about it like a medicine, an alternative medicine, which is really fundamentally what it ought to, how we ought to be thinking about it, women should be more drawn to it.
Betty Aldworth is a founding member of the group Women Grow. She's also the executive director of Students for Sensible Drug Policy. For another perspective on women in the legal cannabis industry, we turn now to Sue Sisley. She researches the effect of medical marijuana on veterans with PTSD, although she's still looking for a home for that research after her contract was terminated by the U of A. She says the industry, including the research side, is male-dominated, but has gotten a little less so as marijuana has become less controversial.
As we've been trying to ramp up our marijuana research, I've interacted with many industry leaders at different events, and I've noticed that it has traditionally been male-dominated, but over the last year, I've started seeing more and more women leaders emerging in this area, showing proficiency, not just on the business side, but also in terms of strain science and as horticulturists. As the marijuana industry proceeds, we need people who are experts in strain science. And women traditionally have not played a big role in the scientific arena, but they are starting to enter this world and prove themselves. You know, that was surprising to me when I started embarking on our marijuana research. I realized that there really weren't any women in the research area. There's so many blockades to conducting marijuana research. There's so many layers of federal approval and just a mountain of red tape at every turn. And so most women who are in academia aren't dare going to enter this field because they know that if you're in a publish or perish system within a university, there's no way you'd be able to survive. Because look at our study, it's taken us 4 years to get to this point, and we're still, you know, miles away from getting the study implemented.
Why do you think it is that you're seeing more women in this industry in the last year or so?
I think that it's a philosophical issue for women. Women see access to marijuana as a sign of compassion. They believe that compassionate access to lab-tested marijuana should be a right for sick patients. Women are starting to see that they can have an impact in this area, and that's just our natural tendency, right?
Do you think that there do need to be efforts to encourage women to enter this field, or do you think that women will continue to enter it sort of on their own without outside efforts?
I think there's a groundswell of women's groups around the country that are starting to explore this and empower each other to enter this arena. And so I think that I don't think we need to have a deliberate intervention to bring women in because they're already recognizing the value of this work and the need for it. But I think that down the road, it's going to be surprising. I think you'll see the ratios change, and I think women may start becoming the dominant force in this field.
Sue Sisley is a medical doctor and studies the effect of medical marijuana on veterans suffering from PTSD. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ at 251.
KJZZ is supported by Thunderbird School of Global Management at Arizona State University, an alliance forged on a common purpose to develop stronger global business leaders. Learn more about this new school at asu.thunderbird.edu.
The West African country of Liberia has always had a strong relationship with the United States. Liberia was founded by freed American and Caribbean slaves, and the U.S. continues to help Liberia try to achieve greater stability and long-term economic improvement.
But the country faces great challenges. Ebola is the big one right now, of course, but more generally, corruption is weighing Liberia down. Against that background, a children's book has been published aimed at warning young people in Liberia about the dangers of corruption.
The book is proving a hit in Liberian schools, even being added to their reading list. The BBC's business correspondent Russell Padmore has been reading the book and talking to its author.
The book focuses on two children, twins who travel to Liberia's capital city of Monrovia with their aunt, who works for the government. They're caught in the aunt's car in a traffic jam and witness her bribing a policeman to get through the traffic. To help young readers understand what this episode means, there's a song to go with the book. The singer says corruption is in the school and in the church, and it's getting too much, but say no to corruption and you will be all right. In the book, the two children also go to a shop where they buy chocolate which turns out to be old and stale, but their aunt does nothing about it. That's because the shopkeeper has paid her to keep quiet about selling out-of-date food. Rob Telpaley is the author of the book, which is proving a hit at Liberian schools.
The reception towards the book has been phenomenal. The Ministry of Education, surprisingly enough, has been my biggest supporter. The Minister of Education proper has endorsed the book. She was at the launch. She spoke very highly of it. And they actually placed the book on the supplemental reader for third to fifth graders in Liberia. And parents have come to me and said, thank you so much for creating a story that my children can read and relate to.
Rob Telpaley, Liberian author of the children's book called Bagba, which teaches children about corruption. Bagba means trickery in the local Bassa language. Corruption is widespread in many countries, and stamping it out is a challenge, of course. But the hope in Liberia is that educating children about what it is, how it undermines the rule of law, and it's bad news for a country, could change society for the better in the long term.
That's the BBC's business correspondent, Russell Padmore. The Arizona Cardinals were hoping to become the first NFL team ever to host a Super Bowl.
But a lot of Valley football fans had their hearts broken last weekend when the Cardinals lost their first-round playoff game to the Carolina Panthers.
The people who own and run hotels and restaurants, though, were probably less disappointed because that means thousands more out-of-town fans will likely make their way to the Valley for the big game. But economist Elliot Pollack says local residents don't usually attend the game itself.
Why? Because the tickets are very expensive, and therefore somebody's going to have to really want to go. Or if you're a fan who has season tickets and you get chosen in the lottery, you're saying, all right, am I going to go to this game and forego the thousands of dollars I could get for my tickets online or through a scalper? And the worst is I stay home and watch it on TV, which is not that big a deal, or I'll just go tailgate like a lot of people do. But the bottom line is certainly some people would have gone to the game just because the Cardinals were in it, and that means that somebody from out of town probably would have been shut out. But you got to keep in mind two things. One, again, it's a relatively small number that would have gone to the Super Bowl to see the Cardinals, then are going to go to the Super Bowl, period. And two, a large number of people come to town to see the Super Bowl events, to go to those events, and never go to the Super Bowl.
This is such a great time of year for the weather here as opposed to other places that we're already getting some of these people. So are we thinking that the folks who do come from the Super Bowl and for the Super Bowl and other events, most of these people would not have come otherwise, even for a few days?
Well, occupancy rates that time of year are high anyway. But if you've been here during these events, you know that there are no rooms available and people are renting out their homes. So a lot of these people would not have been here. They simply wouldn't have thought of coming. And again, there's a lot of events connected with the Super Bowl and the Pro Bowl, with the Barrett-Jackson auction, with virtually everything. There are side events, and that's where these people are spending a lot more money than somebody who just comes around to sit around the pool for 3 days. It's a completely different visitor.
What about longer term, in the sense that we have people, as you said, who can spend some money Is there something that may get the housing industry here doing better? Are there going to have more people who invest in homes, that kind of thing?
What people tend to overlook are the benefits you can't quantify, although there have been attempts made. There are huge impacts because Phoenix is seen on TV for literally weeks before the game, and especially the week of the game and during the game. And it's going to be portrayed as a nice place with nice weather, people in shirt sleeves, and just a generally great environment. When you're in Chicago and it's 3 feet of snow on the ground and the wind's blowing and you can't go outside and you're stuck in your house, boy, that has an impact on you. And so, yes, it has an impact in terms of PR, in terms of getting people here to vacation, in terms of getting people to consider Phoenix when they might have otherwise considered Florida. But it has more of an impact than that, because a lot of CEOs fly into town. You try to land a jet at Scottsdale or one of the municipal airports, it's very difficult during the Super Bowl weekend. Those people are here. They see what's going on. They consider Phoenix as a place to basically open an office or maybe move a plant. That's a big deal. That type of publicity, that type of exposure is something you can't get if you don't have an event like the Super Bowl.
Economist Elliot Pollack of the Scottsdale-based firm Elliott D. Pollack & Company.
With President Obama in town, obviously that means Air Force One was in town. I don't know, Steve, did you see it while it was at Sky Harbor taking off?
No, in fact, I was looking for Harrison Ford to beat up Gary Oldman like in that movie. Didn't see it.
Well, some things you might not know about Air Force One, things I at least didn't know. The plane carries more than 53,000 gallons of fuel and weighs 833,000 pounds.
I guess it's a good thing the price of gas is down.
Yes.
That was a great story you did earlier on in the program. Onboard electronics are hardened to protect against an electromagnetic pulse.
There's a 4,000 square feet of floor space on three levels, including an extensive suite for the president, featuring a large office, conference room, and of course, the executive washroom.
And if the president has any money on any NFL games during the regular season, it has 19 televisions as well, Mark.
That's pretty nice.
Yeah.
That's like a sports bar.
No
in
red
the
zone
air.
Package for him.
Seriously.
He just has it right there.
Be sure to stick with us. Tomorrow for the show, we'll have a look ahead to Monday's State of the State address from Governor Ducey, as well as the start of the legislative session. We'll also tour the Valley's newest museum, which is set to open next week.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer and Maria Springs are the digital team, the managing editor, Al Macias. The executive producer is the unpredictable one, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. If you have some fun facts about your own private jet, that's not Air Force One, let us know that too. The show at KJZZ.org. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.
I think it's important to be here and to protest and to say with all these people, we are sad and very angry.
A day of mourning and solemn defiance in Paris.
For Thursday, January 8th, this is All Things Considered.
I'm Alyssa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In this hour, the mood in Paris, one day after the deadly attacks on the satirical weekly.
And more on one of the suspects. Sharif Kouachi was convicted of being part of a ring that recruited jihadists to fight in Iraq.
He was a little fish. He was one of the hangers-on, one of the followers, one of the terrorist wannabes.
Also, a survivor of the Boston Marathon bombings on the start of the trial.
I can't even imagine what people are going through because I know what we go through on a regular basis, and it's just a part of us now.
First, this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Local French media are reporting the suspects in a deadly shooting at a French satirical magazine may be barricaded in a house north of Paris. Lauren Frere reports from the French capital on a national day of mourning.
Even as
as France observed a moment of silence, a giant manhunt was underway across the capital and beyond. One suspect turned himself in to police, but two others are on the run, robbing a gas station and carjacking a bystander in separate incidents. The men are believed to be brothers in their early 30s, French citizens who are Muslims. At least one had a prior conviction for terror offenses. Police say they're armed and dangerous and are asking any witnesses for help. Several other people have been detained for questioning. There are reports of separate attacks on police officers and mosques across the country, though it's unclear whether they're linked. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Paris.
California Democrat Barbara Boxer announced today she's decided not to seek re-election after serving in the U.S. Senate since 1992. Liberal Democrat who helped bring about a new era for women in the upper reaches of political power, announcing via video she will not be running in 2016. Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi called Boxer's decision a great loss for Congress and the country.
She is one of the most unselfish politicians I have ever known of. She has always shared her ideas. She has always shared the credit. She's always tried to help people succeed with their ideas.
74-year-old Boxer was first elected to the House in 1982 before reaching the Senate a decade later. President Obama is continuing his tour, promoting his administration's efforts to boost the economy after an appearance at a Ford plant in Michigan yesterday. The president, during a stop in Phoenix, talked about efforts to turn around the housing slump. Among other things, the president says the administration will